Then he said, you may take LSD 3 more times, and then you must stop forever. Well, between the time I'd sent the letter and the time I received the answer, I had taken it once, so that left me either 2 or 3, depending on how you counted. And I started to wrestle with this problem. After all, I'm supposedly sort of in the LSD business in one way or another. I mean, I'm not pushing it, but I certainly am talking about it and thinking about it and built systems about it. And so I didn't answer his letter, and I got a wire, did you receive my letter? And I sent a wire back that I received his letter. And I continued to wrestle in my own mind with this issue. Now, in the past week, I have been, I have received, I think, 3 special delivery communications strongly urging me to be wise enough at this conference to present Baba's views and to espouse them. Now, it's very easy to take a reasonably easy way out and say, in effect, well, this guy probably never had LSD. Now, how does he really know? Okay? Except that the letters are very sophisticated. He says, look, I understand the difference between the psychedelics and the opiates, you know? Right? I mean, he's not. And he says, what you get addicted to is the experience, not the drug. But you keep depending on it. And then he instructed a number of his followers in the East and West to set out on a pilgrimage to stop the use of drugs in the United States. Now, up until this point, all of the writings I'd ever read of Mayor Baba said, in effect, don't worry, be happy. Take it easy. It's all happening. Okay. Love is the way. And now suddenly are coming special delivery directives about not doing things, about derangement. Now, my policy under these situations is to look within myself. And I have been doing that as intensively as I know how. I have indeed, Paula, not taken LSD since February 14th. And it just doesn't feel right to me, what he says. And it is not in line with my own experiences. And I am not a person of blind faith. And therefore, in being honest to my own experiences, illusory though they may turn out to be, I must take the position I am taking, because psychedelics indeed took me from being a very limited, very somewhat mechanical Western man and opened my eyes enough so that I could even read Mayor Baba without scoffing at him.
Best evidence is.
And the flaw in his letter was saying a few souls like you. Well, who else?
People you trust.
Questions, please.
You will not be the third.
Dr. Albert, would you please make a comment about SoulCo and where people may get the information of this organization?
SoulCo is a non-geographical insemination dissemination organization, which has its sole existence in box 309 at Menlo Park. And if you advise them of your address, a lengthy bibliography on consciousness expansion comes your way, along with all of the other things that interest us, along with pictures of Shiva Shaktis and mandalas and stuff like that. It's a, I realize that all we could hope for as a social institution at this point, you see, I went to Los Angeles and gave some lectures, and there were like 1,000 people there, and then I sent out a questionnaire, said, if you want to fill it out, send it in, and hundreds of these questionnaires came back of people saying, let's all collaborate in setting up something humanly beautiful to do. And I looked and I looked and I looked, and I realized that the heterogeneity of all of us, because many of us never took psychedelics but arrived at the states of consciousness through many other means, that there wasn't any single game we could work at together at the moment. The best thing we could do was set up some kind of a nervous system, which is a mailing list, if you will. And so I just started to offer Box 309 and have been every month or 2 months sending out a mailing as fast as I could afford it. And there are now 8,000 people on the West Coast who are us, whoever we are. And they are, it's a constant stream of the most beautiful letters from a tremendously wide range of people with diverse interests. That's what Silco is. Box 309, Menlo Park.
And I do you have any comments about turning on without drugs? I've only turned on once without, but several times with, and it wasn't a dream, but it began in a dream state at the very end of a morning sleep, and I haven't been able to replicate that sort of experience since. And I'm wondering whether you know anybody that has, or what steps have been made in this direction.
Well, the question concerns turning on without drugs. Abe Maslow's book, whether you're familiar with it or not, or his work, he is concerned with peak experiences. And he points out that most people have had these experiences at one time or another spontaneously, but weren't able to label them, all right? And as you read through his accounts, you find a number of settings that are indeed settings that seem to precipitate these. Now, if you argue that what you mean by turn-on is a chemical alteration of the brain, that there is clear evidence that the mystic visionaries and the psychedelic visionaries and the diet visionaries and so on were having some common core spiritual experience, so there was some common chemical alteration occurring to all of them, then you notice that this chemical alteration can be brought about either from the body through the endocrine system or from the cerebral cortex downward, if you will. Then you see that by using, for example, a mantra, repeating some phrase. For example, just one of the little things in Paul Repp's Zen Flesh and Bones in the back of it, like just sit down and get into a very comfortable position, candle, very quiet, and or outside, and say, let me slowly turn off my senses, look within, and find my own true self, or my own calm center, or something. And just keep simplifying and simplifying. It's a repeated mantra that will take you there, Will. Now, there are also any number of external environmental things like mandalas or, you know, various settings or scenes that will do it. You working from your body, it is possible clearly through diet. It's clearly possible through a number of kinds of physical yoga, breathing, for example. But what I was pointing out in that community concern is that there have been times when I've been living in a community when I can come home to this place hung up, caught, busy being Dick Alpert, angry at power, you know, all my games, walk in and I become high when I walk in the door. Right? And I used to measure houses and say, well, that's about a 75 microgram house.
Would you compare and contrast subjectively psilocybin and LSD?
Contrast psilocybin and LSD.
Subjectively.
Subjectively. Well, that's a little hard for me to do accurately because all my psilocybin experiences were predominantly before my LSD experiences, and I haven't had a psilocybin available to me for a long time. The best I can say at the moment is that and furthermore, it has... Okay, all right. Okay. When we were taking psilocybin, we were using dosages anywhere from 2 to 20 milligrams and 26 milligrams, something like that. Now, as I understand it, a comparable dose to 200 micrograms of LSD might be anywhere above 60 milligrams instead of the smaller dosage. So that I don't know that I have comparable data. The experience I had with psilocybin, almost all the experiences were of the... if you define a ladder of experiences, let me give you a quick ladder and then I can show you where it is on the ladder. The most probable experience people report is heightened sensitivity, color, kinesthesis, sound, and so on. And that's a very easy thing to experience. And external hallucinations, the walls creeping and crawling and so on. Then the next level of experience is when it's a social situation, is feeling that seeing the other person with figure ground reverse, that is, the ways in which we are different becomes background and the ways which we are same becomes figure. And that's quite different from the way most of us live every day, where the way in which we're the same is background and the figure stands out as individual differences, especially among Westerners. Now, under that condition, there is still a you and a me. It's just that we see that you and me are made of the same thing, right? And we say, wow, you and I are one, but I still see you as you and I as I. Now, it's the next level after that where all that starts to disintegrate, where your body starts to fall apart and it all starts to turn into energy, for example. Or other levels where it becomes unity in the perceptual sense as well, and the you-ness disappears. Now, as far as I know, most of my psilocybin, or I say most of my psilocybin experiences, were at the level where one experienced that social unity, tremendous closeness to other people, tremendous, we used to call it the love drug, because it just made people so close and at one and just human love heaps, in the most beautiful sense of the word. Right? And that was psilocybin. Then along came LSD and just blew our minds, you know. It was... It was a whole other level because the LSD then became a very, it was not social. It was not a social drug. It was too profound. It just took you way beyond that. It was all molecules or all energy. And many people have had a great deal of difficulty trying to use LSD as a social drug. Let's take a little LSD and have a groovy evening. Well, now, if you're going to do that, don't do it because it's illegal, but if, hypothetically, if you're planning, I don't know how to say it legally, I have heard that people who have had them, well, I'll give you an example. For example, I've gone to the ballet with LSD, and I can strongly urge people to take it a number of hours before they're going to do anything, and don't try to do any external social game till maybe the fourth or fifth hour, because you may be just a little too much out of contact. Now, the ballet is very interesting. First time I sat in the orchestra watching Nureyev, and it was quite an experience because Nureyev definitely transcends being Nureyev, just becomes the essence of form, and it's an exquisite experience. And he was like just going through space, free space. The next time I did this, I sat in the balcony, and Nureyev wasn't dancing, and the whole thing looked like a species that was trying to fly but hadn't quite made it off the ground yet. And I spent the whole evening with this great sadness, because I was caught in the evolutionary significance of the ballet. Sir.
Yeah, I want first to thank you for directing your attention to the things that I've been thinking about and giving me some very good answers. And I'd like to ask if you could share with us something more specific of the answer you have about how easy it is to go from knowing where you want to go to finding these other paths such as diet, meditation, and so on. You've said it's easy. And you've given some general indications. I think it'd be something very worthwhile for you to give us just one specific example, perhaps, of how you've done it and how it felt.
Well, it's really what it is, as I understand it, is selective perception. that if you don't know what you're looking for, it's very hard to find it. And that the minute you know what you're looking for, it's practically everywhere you look. And that there practically is nothing in the environment that you can't use as an alarm clock or as some technique to increase your awareness. For example, you're driving down the street, and Gurdjieff has a great exercise. Driving down the street, pick a truck or a sign up a couple of hundred yards ahead and say, see if I can remain completely conscious of my hands on the steering wheel between here and the sign. And you'll be amazed at how difficult that is to do. How quickly you go to sleep, and you just wake up and suddenly remember you had even undertaken that task. And you can do a whole set of little, and Gurdjieff has perhaps one of the most sophisticated Western methods suitable for Westerners for waking up, which is a systematic technique for observing yourself. Now, it's very interesting, and I'll be very straight about this. When I went to visit the Gurdjieff groups in New York, I found a lot of people who disappointed me. And then I noticed that a lot of psychedelic people came into the group, and that the man that was running the group found them very responsive to what he was talking about. Right? And I then understood that, again, as I said before, once you know where that point is, then any method is one that you can make use of. And that the people that had had psychedelics could make fantastically rapid use of the Gurdjieff method, much more rapidly than the very systematic students who had been working at it but did not have an anticipation of what the end state was like. But if just once you and I have been one, how can we ever really go back into being defensive from one another without somewhere knowing? You know, somewhere knowing? And it's really interesting because the whole life becomes very much like a tennis match in which you are playing the game very hard and enjoying the exquisiteness of the game, and at the same time you can look across the net at your opponent and smile at the beauty of the day. And it's that multiple level, and then it becomes N levels. It's like baklava, you know, it's so many levels you can't even count. Yes?
I'd like to ask a question that is reverse of everything that I've been reading and hearing. I would like to know if there's been anything done on the opposite side of the coin, that what happens when a person has a psychedelic experience, an aesthetic, sensitive, kind, loving person is going through a psychedelic experience in a squalid, dirty, unpleasant, raucous surroundings. Have there been any such experiments, and how have they resulted?
Many more than any of us can imagine.
Could you tell me what happens?
Well, it seems to be true. Tim pointed this out a long time ago, that at first it appears that you seem to be very dependent on the setting, and that your set or preparation can very easily be overridden by bad setting. And then as you get more experienced and more trusting of the process, you can ride through, if you will, bad settings because of the strength of your set. And finally, if you're a truly enlightened holy man, you can move through any setting without ever, if you will, losing this consciousness. And if you consider for a moment, you realize that the drugs are a setting because they are an external thing that is part of that environment, or your body, which is a setting for your consciousness also. And you can understand that finally the point is of being fully conscious without any of these external, if you will, dependency of some sort. Now, there are a number of reports of people who have been in bad settings, who have had very bad experiences. Now, let me describe what bad is, because that's a big topic these days. See, I haven't been one of these people that's arguing for strong controls, and I'm not worried about what's happening. I'm sorry, I just can't join the throng. I'd like to, but I don't, and I know an awful lot of teenagers. I had a very interesting evening recently in Los Angeles. I met with a group of mothers and fathers and sons and daughters. Sons and daughters were all 15 and 16 years old, and they were all taking LSD, and the parents were all upset. And that was the definition of the two groups. On one side were upset parents, and on the other side were teenagers, drugged teenagers. And the parents started out with the accusing, "You've done this to our children." And one of the boys said, "Now, mother." And there was one really great line in that whole meeting when one of the mothers said, "The thing about my son is that he's gotten so good. I wish he'd be bad like an adolescent. He's thoughtful. He's loving. He wants me to take LSD with him." He brings his girlfriend to the house, and it's all wonderfully. She says, "This isn't what adolescence is supposed to be doing. It doesn't feel natural to me." Right? Now, as I've been interviewing literally hundreds of teenagers who have been using LSD, because I do spend a great deal of my time, if you will, out in the field, doing sociological surveys, I found out that most of the sessions that kids are having quite loosely, they are spending a great deal of energy struggling with, and they spend a great deal of time in very tense, high energy output because they have no calm center. But the other thing I noticed is that something happens to them over time, whether they went into it for that reason or not, that gets them starting to listen. A group starts out, for example, I talked to one 16-year-old a couple of weeks ago. He said, "The first time I took acid, I was at a party in Los Angeles, and somebody was handing around these things, and they said they were LSD, and it would be a gas, and we'd all have a sexual ball, and so I took them, and it was the worst thing that ever happened to me. And I spent all the time in the bathroom on the floor crying." Now, first of all, the disposition of that particular case depends completely on who he comes in contact with next. The evidence is very clear. If he comes in contact with somebody who does not understand what the psychedelic experience is about, the likelihood is that that fellow will move off into a short-term psychotic episode because he will be surrounded by people who think he is crazy. And that is the setting in which he would then function. So the police and, like, I was talking to a doctor who's here who is part of a research group studying this problem, and they have intakes every night in their hospital for bad reactions. And I said, "Well, what do you do when the guy gets there?" "Well, we put him in a room. We have a nurse go and sit with him." "Well, has she ever had the experience?" "Oh, of course not." "Well, now, I'll show you a simple thing like this. If you are sitting in the middle of a very wild internal tangle, and anybody asks you a question, like, 'How are you feeling?'" Right? Very reasonable, loving question. "Come in." What nurse wouldn't ask that question? "How are you feeling now?" That is enough to push a person off into the wildest, isolating experience. And it would seem to me an obvious thing in view of the data we know on set and setting that every hospital should have a trained psychedelic person there. And when a person comes in, he is put with this individual who sits with him and who understands what's happening. The evidence is if you end up with somebody who does understand, and what we've been getting for years now, telephone calls all hours of the night and day. Like a girl called me the other day, a month ago actually. She said, "I took LSD 5 days ago and I'm still high and I'm scared. And I keep going up and coming down. Am I insane?" Right? Now, I said to her, "Well, you know, you're really very lucky. Because most of us after a session have to wait a long time before we can explore again. And by your being able to go in and out, you can explore levels of consciousness and build the bridges much faster than the rest of us can. You can make a tremendous amount of gain in understanding your own samsara. And call me every day and let me know. Gal was joyous. Now, what are the probabilities that she would have gotten that reaction from any hospital, any other situation she would have turned to in our society? So it is true that bad settings lead these kids to bad experiences. But this kid said an interesting thing. He said, after that experience, I knew there was something there, but I wasn't going to have it with them anymore. And what I did was I went out and I bought some acid, and I got my best friend, and we went down by the ocean. This is 16 years old. And we sat on a rock, and we looked out at the ocean, and we took LSD. Now, is that wisdom? Is that social irresponsibility? Is it some kind of guts information? But it's this kind of business. And I guess you see what you're ready to look for. The people that come in contact with me obviously are not the people that are having these horrible nightmares that we're reading all about. Best evidence is that it's well worth working to make the setting good. And by a good setting, it really means a very safe and secure place. People you trust and love. A place where you will not be disturbed. No likelihood there's going to be a knock on the door or a telephone call. Turn it all off. Have a babysitter for the children. It's got to be a completely a protected environment from the unexpected until you know better what you're doing. Out in nature, if you can provide a secure, quiet enough place, it's great. And then surround yourself with things that are in tune with the universe. And the fewer things you have created by men's minds, the better. Therefore, rocks, water, candles, dirt, wood, a fireplace, all good. And if you have Indian oriental rugs or Indian prints, these, after all, are probably the hashish fantasies of somebody or other. Questions? Yes. I think we'll stop in about two more questions.
Do you have any suggestions for anybody who has a higher level of consciousness than the ordinary society to live in peace in that society without going insane?
Well, I think the question reflects that the level isn't high enough. Because as I understand it, as one increases one's consciousness, one is able to see more and more ways in which to be in tune with the world around you. Now, at first, you feel somewhat separate from it. But then, after all, if the experience is indeed a unitive one, like, I'll tell you a very interesting experience. I was going east with a friend of mine who was a very advanced guy. And we got to Chicago, and we were both, just from driving across the country together and being together, we were both extremely high. Wide open, just in this little Volkswagen, speeding across the country. We got to Chicago, and he said, well, when I leave you now, everybody I meet, I'm going to try to make a real contact with. Now, this was a challenge, and this horrified me, because I was about to go to a set of technical meetings on computer programming. And I was going to then go to my parents' home. And the task looked Herculean. And I started out, and I found myself at University of Illinois in an elderly mathematician's office. And he was behind his mask of being an elderly mathematician. And I looked at him, you know, with love and with openness and, you know. We have become very good friends, I am happy to report. The thing worked for about 4 days. until I had just worn down. Because the energy involved in, right? But I don't find any boredom in finding things to do, nor do I find it that the world isn't totally open to being lived at the highest level I can reach at all times. And it is merely my own ability to get rid of me before I can find the place in it all. I think I'll stop now, because I'm...